From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is at a conference for a few days. When CBS correspondent Bob Simon and his crew ventured out into the desert during the Gulf War, they left behind the Pentagon press pool. 3 days later, all that was found was their Jeep. Coming up, we talk to Bob Simon about the ensuing 40 days when he was beaten, interrogated, and finally released by the Iraqi government. B.D. Wong won a Tony for his performance in the Broadway hit M. Butterfly. He played a man impersonating a woman. Now he's got a bigger challenge. We'll talk about how he manages 11 different roles in the new one-man show, Herringbone. And world music commentator Milo Miles checks out the latest from St. Petersburg, the Turi M. Quartet's first album. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The head of the United Nations Office for Peacekeeping Operations, Marek Golding, came under mortar fire in the Bosnian capital today. Pierre Vickery reports that the UN official had earlier protested being detained for several hours at a Serbian roadblock south of the city.
The convoy of three armored personnel carriers, including Marek Golding, narrowly missed being hit by a mortar shell while on its way to the Bosnian Presidency building from the UN Sarajevo headquarters. The attack coincided with reports that an agreement had been reached between a Yugoslav army delegation and members of the Bosnian government for a 24-hour ceasefire. The deal would allow dead and wounded soldiers still lying in city streets to be taken to hospital, a general prisoner exchange, and the re-establishment of food, water, and electricity supplies to besieged Yugoslav army barracks in the city. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The AFL-CIO endorsed Bill Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination today, citing the Arkansas governor's pledge to stop America's decline into a low-wage, low-skill economy. AFL-CIO President Lane Kirkland said the endorsement came late in the season because there was no quick consensus among the member unions. He said the delay did not suggest that unions were unhappy with Clinton's labor record in Arkansas. Kirkland said the Labor Federation agrees with Clinton's beliefs in universal health care, a middle-class tax cut, fair trade, and the right to strike without being permanently replaced. Clinton is more than two-thirds of the way toward clinching the nomination, and he's expected to pick up more delegates in today's Indiana and North Carolina primaries. Clinton and President Bush are also expected to win the District of Columbia primary today. Laura Canoy reports.
Bill Clinton is likely to win today's D.C. Democratic primary. The question is by how much. Supporters of former candidate Paul Tsongas put up campaign posters in several D.C. neighborhoods this week. Tsongas still has some strength, especially among wealthier, more educated residents. Former California Governor Jerry Brown is not expected to do well today. Brown might gain some black support by saying he'd choose Jesse Jackson as a running mate. And some of D.C.'s liberal political activists back Brown as the anti-establishment candidate. But while Clinton has paid frequent visits to local officials and the city's politically important black churches, Brown has hardly campaigned here. Poll workers report light voter turnout so far. Elections officials say without Jesse Jackson drawing black voters, participation could hit record lows. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost nearly 19 points to close at 3,359. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. A Senate independent counsel ended his investigation today, saying he was unable to learn who leaked information on sexual harassment allegations against Clarence Thomas and on ethics charges against five senators. Peter Fleming said that he was unable to identify the source who provided NPR's Nina Totenberg and Newsday's Timothy Phelps with information about Anita Hill's charges against the then Supreme Court nominee. Fleming said that evidence indicates that there were multiple sources of leaks in the Senate Ethics Committee investigation of senators who are connected to savings and loan operator Charles Keating. The splintering of the former republics of the Soviet Union continues. Today, the Parliament of the Crimea, a region of Ukraine, declared its independence from Ukraine. NPR's Mike Schuster has more from Moscow.
Just as Ukraine declared its independence from the Soviet Union, now the Crimea has declared that it is an independent state. And just as Ukraine held a referendum on independence last December, Now Crimea plans such a referendum this summer. The Crimea is a peninsula in the Black Sea, home to some 2.5 million people, more than half of them ethnic Russians. Until 1954, it was part of Russia, but Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev transferred it to Ukrainian jurisdiction. The Crimea is certain to become another explosive issue between Russia and Ukraine. The Ukrainian government has recently offered the Crimea considerable autonomy if it remains part of Ukraine, but Ukraine's President Leonid Kravchuk, visiting the United States this week, threatened to impose his rule if the Crimea goes ahead with an independence referendum. Nationalists in Russia are hoping that the independence declaration will lead to the return of the Crimea to Russian control. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The Russian government announced plans today to make the ruble convertible on world markets. Russian economist Konstantin Kogolovsky said that beginning on August 1st, the ruble will have a fixed rate with a floating margin that will let it move up and down slightly in relation to the dollar. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. CBS correspondent Bob Simon was one of those reporters who broke away from the Pentagon press pool during the Gulf War. But he was the unlucky one, the one who was caught by Iraqi soldiers. For 40 days, Simon and his three-man crew were kept in solitary confinement, at times blindfolded, interrogated, and beaten. They were released after the war's ceasefire. The details of that time are now documented in Simon's new book, 40 Days. Bob Simon has worked with CBS for 25 years. He covered wars in Vietnam, Lebanon, Israel, and Central America, and is now their chief Middle East correspondent based in Tel Aviv. I asked him what story he was looking for the day he was captured.
Dumb answer, not much of a story at all. We were just looking around because the system had already been put in place by the Pentagon's Information Bureau that restricted us from really doing anything that put us all in packs that were to be led around by the nose by Pentagon information officers. So we just, our whole idea was to find out what was going on our own, and we had done so a few days earlier. We'd gone up to another border position between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and found an awful lot of things that had not been reported in the Pentagon pools. We found a Saudi oil refinery which had been hit by Iraqi artillery, which was burning. We found Saudi positions which had been abandoned by their defenders. We found a U.S. Marine unit under fire. It was clear to us then that the only way to report the story was to go out on our own. So we just did that again. We did another take. We drove up to another road, another place in Saudi Arabia, another place along the northern frontier, and we never got back there.
Tell us how you got captured.
Well, we strolled across this border. We just were sort of wanted to have a look at the no man's land, which is just another expanse of sand, which is all there is out there. There's nothing else, not the hint of a curve or a hill. We were just looking around. We also thought it would be sort of nice to have a Kuwait dateline. So we wanted to see if we were actually in Kuwait, and we were walking towards some signs in the no man's land, which we thought delineated the actual border between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. When we got there, we found that they were just directional signs pointing to parking lots. And we just started heading back, and my colleague Peter Bluff said, "There's a vehicle heading towards us." And I glanced around and saw that there was something kicking up sand in the distance, but I couldn't tell what kind of vehicle it was. We were at that point about 200, 250 meters from the border, and we didn't really, I think, have a chance to make a run for it. And I think we were already into something which would become quite prominent in our lives for the next 40 days. We were already into fantasies. The Saudis had told us that a lot of Iraqis were defecting to their Saudi forces. In fact, one of our colleagues, a CBS cameraman, an Iraqi soldier, had surrendered to him the day before. So I think our first thought was, maybe these are Iraqi defectors. Won't that be fun?
Did you think being a member of the press corps was going to be any protection for you once you realized that these were Iraqi soldiers not defecting, but there to take you to take you somewhere and then eventually to take you prisoner?
Well, I don't think it would be the operative word here. I think that this is something I try to deal with in the book. I think that when you've been a foreign correspondent for a long time, which really means spending your life going from one trouble zone to another, as long as you've been lucky, as long as you haven't gotten into trouble, I think there's something in you operating as some kind of subconscious or even unconscious sense of invulnerability. And it's other people who get into trouble, and it's, again, how many times have you heard it's not going to happen to you. And but at the precise moment that the Jeep came up and then situation, as they say, evolved very quickly. Things were happening so quickly. I don't think there was anything that could properly be qualified as a thought.
What was your greatest fear then?
Well, I'll tell you, it took a while for real fears to set in. In fact, if I were to answer the question very candidly, and I'm rather embarrassed to articulate it, I think my greatest fear at the very beginning was I wasn't going to make it back to Saudi Arabia that night to file a very good story I had. And that's how distant my mind was still from the reality which was overtaking me. And it took some time, and this was something I tried to focus on in the book, how long it takes for, a fairly normal mind to really deal with a very, very oppressive new reality, that it took some time before I really realized that I wasn't a reporter anymore, I wasn't going to go back to some air-conditioned newsroom, that the Ministry of Information in Iraq didn't give a damn about us, and even if they did, had no power, that we were in a very, very serious situation.
You were first taken to some bunkers.
That's right, some bunkers outside Kuwait.
And what kind of interrogation were you exposed to?
First interrogation was very proper and very, very correct. In fact, there was a dichotomy during the 40 days. That first afternoon, we were in the hands of the Iraqi army. And they always behaved properly to us. We were never beaten up by the army. We never tortured by the army. When they interrogated us, it was we were blindfolded. It wasn't pleasant.
What did they want from you? What kind of information?
Basically, they wanted to know who we were, what we were doing, and who sent us. And their problem, and I could understand their problem, was they just, being Iraqis, having no sense of a Western press corps and what a Western press corps does or tries to do, they just didn't believe it. They didn't believe that we were journalists just nosing around. They thought, my God, four guys, particularly we were sort of in quasi-army gear as well, that to them, it's a paranoid regime. To them, anyone nosing around like that must be a spy. Therefore, they wanted to know who we were spying for, who sent us, what we were looking for. And that was the focus of most of the interrogations for the next 6 weeks.
Was there any answer that would satisfy that question about whether you were an agent of the CIA except for yes?
No. Because we kept on telling the truth. And one of their lines in different interrogations in different places was, your answers are not satisfactory. And I would say, but they are true. It turned into a like Samuel Beckett kind of dialogue. They're not satisfactory, but they're true, but they're not satisfactory, but they're true. It was, we were on entirely different wavelengths.
I'm speaking with Bob Simon, and he's the CBS News chief Middle Eastern correspondent and was captured during the Gulf War, held for 6 weeks, and he's written a book about his capture, captivity, and the days after his release, and the book is called 40 Days. By some kind of administrative snafu, the Iraqis didn't know that you were Jewish.
That's right. The miracles in one's life, I think, turn out to be the most minute, incredibly trivial bureaucratic errors. I think miracles these days are exercised by bureaucracies because bureaucracies have such a power over our lives. When I was in Saudi Arabia from August at the very beginning, and once the Americans announced that there was a January 15 deadline, then for the first time I felt I could take a break. I could leave for a couple of weeks and go home and see my family because the war wasn't going to start until the 15th of January. So I left for a couple of weeks around Christmas. And then I came back the beginning of January. And when I got back to the International Hotel in Dahran, which was the international press headquarters, as it was the headquarters of the Military Information Bureau, they were very furiously preparing everyone for covering the war, in quotes. And they were handing out, among other things, Red Cross cards. And I lined up to pick up my Red Cross card. Now, a Red Cross card is something that anyone carries who is in a combat zone. It has your name and your rank or position if you're a newsman. and your picture and your blood type in case you get hurt, or and your religion in case you've got to be buried quickly. And I saw that everything was right on mine, except religion. It said Protestant. Mm. And I said to the guy who was a major, who was sitting at this wooden desk, I said, "Hey, that's not right. I'm not Protestant." And he was very apologetic, very polite. He said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Simon, you were away. You were at home when we printed these up. And we checked with your Saudi visa application, and it said next to religion it was blank. So we put in Protestant because most people are." And I said, "Well, I'm not. I'm Jewish. Fix it." And he said, "Okay, sure. I'll have a new one for you tomorrow morning." And then he looked at me, and I wrote about this, and it's something I'll never understand. But he looked at me with a very intense, disquieting kind of look and said, "Are you sure?" And there was something about the way he looked at me that freaked me out. I said, "Ah, forget it," and walked away.
Well,
if that press card had said Jewish on it, they would have shot me right away.
You have no doubt about that?
No doubt about that. No doubt about that.
Why?
Because it would be impossible for anyone associated with the Iraqi regime to think that a Jew could be a bona fide American journalist. A Jew caught inside Iraqi lines would necessarily be an Israeli spy.
So you would be a Jew first and American second?
I don't think America would have even played a part.
I'm speaking with Bob Simon, and he's CBS News chief Middle Eastern correspondent. He was captured during the Gulf War, and he was held captive for 6 weeks, and he's written a book about his captivity, and it's called 40 Days. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is CBS News chief Middle Eastern correspondent Bob Simon. One thing that you write a lot about is the cold, the utter cold that once you were imprisoned, really the inability to get warm. Was that in part the most brutal part of it, not being able to get warm?
The cold and the hunger, because they were both persistent and they never went away. And this is one reason why I'm very glad that I wrote this book very quickly after I got out. The advantage to doing that, even though you're losing some intellectual perspective, the advantage, I think, is you can still capture the immediacy of the experience. And right now, for example, I find it a little bit hard to remember the force of the hunger, the force of the cold. But when I wrote it, I could still remember what it was like, because we middle-class Americans have never experienced hunger. We use the language improperly when you say something like, "Hey, I'm hungry, let's get a pizza." That's not hunger. It's either you feel like a pizza, or the idea tempts you, or you're bored, or you've got some adrenaline flowing or whatever. But it's not hunger. I discovered hunger for the first time in my life. I never knew what it was. Now I know what it is. And it's an overpowering force.
And it's one, when you're feeling hungry like that, you can't think of anything else, because you fantasized a lot about meals, about chocolate. I mean, I assume that part of that was a way of trying to occupy your mind.
No, it wasn't at all. It was uncontrollable. It was completely uncontrollable. And I thought it was also idiosyncratic. And then when I was released, a few weeks after I was released, and I went back to my home base in Israel... Israel was a good place to go to, because there are a lot of people in Israel from both sides of the divide who've been prisoners. And I found that the only people I could talk to in talks that were useful to me were people who had been prisoners before, because anyone else, it just required too much explaining, and I don't think it's really possible to understand if you haven't been there. But when I'd meet another prisoner, and a lot of both Israelis and Palestinians called me and said, "Hey, you know, I've been there, you want to talk?" And I'd say yes, and we would. And I found that a lot of things that I thought had been idiosyncratic were not. That these uncontrollable food fantasies is something that is human. It's something everyone experiences who is undergoing chronic starvation.
Did you use sleep as an escape? A way of kind of exiting yourself from your cell.
Well, when you're in solitary and the conditions are as dismal as they were in this cell, I mean, there was nothing there. If I'd had a pad and I found the other thing I fantasized about was having a pad and pencil. Then I could have done that forever, I felt. That's what I really wanted, but there was nothing. And no light, no nothing. And what you want to sleep as much as you can, but there's a limit to how much you can sleep, particularly since you're not getting any exercise. And and the hunger is a force that keeps you awake, too. What I tried to do, there was no window in this cell, but there was a shaft, an air shaft, that let in a little light, just enough light so I could see my hands during the day. And with this very little amount of light, I got to be able to figure out what time of day it was, what kind of day it was. And there's an enormous difference between just having this little bit of light and it being pitch black. And when day ended in the evening, when it got pitch black in the cell, I tried to stay awake as long as I could. I would tell jokes to myself. I would sing songs under my breath, because if they heard me, they beat me up. And I would just try to stay awake, because the sooner I went to sleep, the sooner I'd wake up again. And it's not one of the great experiences of life to wake up in a cell which is pitch black and freezing. So I would try to linger in the evening so I'd sleep longer. So the lapse of time between my waking up in the morning and the onset of a little bit of light wouldn't be so long. But I never succeeded very much. After it got really black, I'd fall asleep fairly quickly.
Did you get disoriented about how many days were going by, or were there ways that you could actually mark time?
There was one way, and that's very fortunate, because one of the things you discover is that it is crucial to your sanity to keep track of days. All the movies we've all seen with guys making scratches on walls, it's not just a trick, it's not trivial, it's crucial. And the walls in my cell were very hard, hard red bricks, polished red bricks. And I didn't have any kind of instrument or implement. They took everything away from me that could have made a mark in that. But what they did give me, and here's, you know, Iraqi humor, what they did give me was a bar of soap, a fresh new bar of soap. This is funny, because there was no water. So I had a bar of soap but no water. I managed, when they stripped us and shoved before they took us into the cells, I managed to save a button I had from my safari jacket and shoved it into a pajama pocket. And so I had, the only things I had in this cell were a bar of soap, a dry bar of soap, and a button. So the most important part of the day for me was, as soon as I saw that first light in the morning, I would take the bar of soap and draw a line in it with a button.
And would you find yourself looking at that bar of soap?
All the time.
You describe Iraqi humor. I guess that's Iraqi humor, to give someone a bar of soap without any kind of water. But there were also acts of kindness, Iraqi soldiers that would get food to you.
There were two kinds of Iraqis. There were Iraqis, and Iraqis go into the army like people do everywhere. And the Iraqi soldiers were human beings, and some of them were very, very fine human beings. And for the first 6 or 7 days, we were being held, after the first day, which was extremely brutal, we were then taken to an Iraqi army prison camp. We were in the hands of the military. And I can't say that they treated us well, but they did treat us well. The facilities left quite a bit to be desired, but the four of us were together. We were in a cell that was freezing and wet, so we started getting very sick. But it wasn't because they were trying to make life bad for us. That's what they had. And they didn't have much food, but what food they had, they gave us. And some of the soldiers there, the enlisted men in particular, were sweethearts. And they gave us some extra food when they could, and one of them gave us an extra blanket, and one of them even, when he saw how sick we were getting, gave us a kerosene stove he had to put in our cell. And that was, I think, that was one of the third or fourth thing that saved our life, because I think we would have died of pneumonia without it.
Once you were bombed, the building you were in was bombed, you write that the Iraqis had threatened to kill you, but it was the Americans that almost had.
Yeah, there were about 8 levels of irony here. The day that we were bombed, that day, I was hauled down to an interrogation. It was the 25th day I was in solitary confinement. I knew that the difference between my three colleagues and myself was that they were exactly who they said they were, and I was not. I was saying that I am an American Protestant correspondent based in New York. I was, in fact, and am, an American Jewish correspondent based in Tel Aviv. And I figured that time was working against me, that the longer they held me, the more certain it was that eventually they were going to find out. A lot of people know I'm based in Tel Aviv. I do television from there. And eventually, even though most sources of information were closed to Iraq, eventually somebody was going to tip them off, and eventually somebody did. I don't know how it happened, but I was hauled down to an interrogation. And they said, our sources tell us you're Jewish, our sources tell us you're based in Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And I knew that my death warrant had been signed. And there was no mistaking that. And I went back up to my cell, and I was actually very quiet about it. You also discover all sorts of ways to calm your mind, which is something else I try to write about. But I was pretty calm about it. And then that night was the night we were bombed. And indeed, the bombs almost killed us, but they didn't. But had we not been bombed that night, I'm sure they would have killed me within 24 hours.
It seems that coping with your release was a very difficult thing as well, that you were not elated, that there were really difficult periods that you had to deal with.
That's right. This is what I discovered on the downside. And in fact, this was in a way more difficult to write about than the actual prison experience. And I think we sort of figure, I don't know if it's because we've seen too many movies or what, that when you've been through a really tough time and you come out of it and you're alive and you're relatively unscathed and your loved ones are around you and they're all right and they've survived, that you walk off happily into the sunset, and it doesn't work like that at all.
Did you think there was something wrong with you?
I don't know if I thought something was wrong with me, but I knew I was really, I was depressed. Not clinically, but I was not feeling good at all. And I think I haven't spoken to any shrinks about this, really, but I think it makes sense. For example, during the time I was in prison, I didn't have any nightmares. And I think this is because nightmares are a luxury. And when you've got to survive, you just can't permit yourself that. You've got to control your anxiety and all the resources you have are mobilized to do that. And then all of a sudden you're free and you're not in danger anymore. And I think all the overpowering anxiety and fear that you've been keeping bottled up for so long just comes pouring out, and it's at times overwhelming.
Do you still have nightmares?
No, not since I wrote the book. They're all in the book now.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, you think that the book, you were able to put those nightmares to rest, so to speak.
I didn't write the book to do that, but it seems to have done that. I think the book really purged me. It's all there. And in fact, interestingly, now when people ask me, I experienced it several times in the last half hour talking to you, when people ask me questions about the experience, I find that my instinct is sort of to start sort of unconsciously quoting from the book. Hmm. The book has become the experience. The experience has become the book. And the things that aren't in the book, I sort of don't exist anymore.
Well, I thank you, Bob Simon, for joining us today.
I thank you.
Bob Simon's book is called 40 Days. He's the chief Middle Eastern correspondent for CBS News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with B.D. Wong. He won a Tony Award for his performance as the lead in M. Butterfly. He played a man posing as a woman. Now he's taken on a bigger challenge in the new one-man musical, Herringbone. He plays 11 characters, including an 8-year-old boy, his parents, his grandmother, his dance teacher, and a tap-dancing midget named Lou the Frog. Also, world music commentator Milo Miles reviews the Turi M. Quartet's first album. They bring new music from St. Petersburg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Los Angeles, Mayor Tom Bradley says after a second night of relative quiet, some law enforcement personnel have been sent home. But he says that National Guard troops will stay on duty indefinitely. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports.
Mayor Bradley says the Guard has been redeployed throughout the city on various shifts to maximize its impact. But as tensions are reduced, it's much more likely to see a guardsman share a cigarette with a secretary than it is to see him standing on guard with rifle and wooden baton at ready. The mayor says the city's been very quiet over the past 24 hours.
Life has returned to a state of normalcy in the city, and we're continuing with cleanup and with preparations for rebuilding.
Bradley says he doesn't know whether speedier response to the first outbreak of violence by police would have been enough to stop the riot, but he labeled as improper any attempt to deliberately hold back police deployment. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
On Capitol Hill, Democrats have accused President Bush of trying to overlook neglect of the nation's cities by blaming social programs of more than 20 years ago for rioting in Los Angeles. Yesterday, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that programs of the 1960s and 1970s had failed and caused last week's violence. Speaking today on the floor of the House, Democratic leader Richard Gephardt charged that Mr. Bush was someone who preaches to others about personal responsibility but rarely accepts any for himself, and asked if the president would like to see health care programs for the elderly and the poor, along with Head Start, done away with. The president of Bosnia and the Yugoslav army have signed a truce in the ethnic warfare which threatens to dismember the newly independent republic. The U.S. has ruled out sending American troops to support Bosnia, but says it will support U.N. peacekeepers if the ceasefire takes hold. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said, quote, "We should not commit American forces to this conflict." But she added the administration would consider a United Nations peacekeeping force if there is a durable ceasefire. The warring parties have called for several ceasefires, but none has lasted more than a few hours. It's unclear how long this one will last. Serbia may now feel international pressure. A senior U.S. official said the United States would make a new appeal for sanctions against Serbia at an emergency meeting of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. Last month, the United States threatened to make Serbia an international pariah, but found then there was no international consensus. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 19 points to close at 3,359.35. This is NPR News. Voters are going to the polls today in primaries in North Carolina, Indiana, and Washington, D.C. In the Indiana primary, CNN has projected Bill Clinton and President Bush the winners. Clinton has today been endorsed by the AFL-CIO. Today's primaries are expected to move Clinton closer to gaining his party's presidential nomination. But whatever the outcome, challenger Jerry Brown says that he will stay in the race until the convention. There are 122 Republican delegates at stake today and 178 delegates to the Democratic National Convention. Likely independent presidential candidate Ross Perot announced today that he's cutting back on interviews and TV appearances. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Ross Perot says he's ducking out of the spotlight for a while to dedicate his time to building a nationwide organization, finalizing an election strategy, and developing carefully thought-out positions on each major issue. Speaking Speaking to the American Newspaper Publishers Association, the Texas billionaire said he's been besieged by reporters, quote, wanting to know my position on everything from mosquitoes to ants. Perot has been criticized in recent weeks for lacking specifics and shooting from the hip when talking about the nation's problems. For instance, he has suggested the government could save $400 billion a year, in part, by charging Europe and Japan for their defense and cutting off Medicare and Medicaid payments to affluent Americans, such as himself. On Sunday, Perot became defensive when he was grilled on NBC's Meet the Press about inconsistencies in his budget-cutting strategy. Perot has promised a, quote, world-class campaign if supporters succeed in getting his name on the ballot in most of the 50 states. I'm John Burnett reporting.
Officials in Moscow say that for the first time, the Russian ruble will be converted freely into foreign currencies. Beginning July 1st, the ruble will be traded freely on international currency markets. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you went to see M. Butterfly when it was on Broadway, you didn't learn the gender of its star, B.D. Wong, by reading the playbill. Wong had purposely eliminated any pronouns and gender references from his biography. Wong played the role of Song Liling, a Beijing opera star who pretends to be a woman. A French diplomat falls in love with the opera star and carries on a 20-year affair, all the while thinking he's a woman. Not only is Song Liling keeping his gender a secret, he's also using the diplomat to get information for the Chinese government. The play was based on a true story. Wong was a little-known actor at the time, and his anonymity was key to the part and the play. Well, the anonymity has vanished, but B.D. Wong has kept his name. Since M. Butterfly, he's appeared in The Tempest, playing opposite Frank Langella, and in a number of movies, including Family Business, The Freshman, and most recently, Father of the Bride. B.D. Wong is currently performing in a one-man show in Philadelphia called Herringbone. He sings and dances and plays 11 different characters, from a small child to an old woman. Herringbone tells the story of an 8-year-old boy possessed by the spirit of a 37-year-old tap-dancing midget who's seeking revenge on his partner. As B.D. Wong tells it, playing all 11 parts is rather like having a group of imaginary friends.
I mean, we're always told that when you talk to yourself or that when you pretend that there's an imaginary person, you're a crazy person, and it's discouraged in civilized society. And so here I get to, you know, go up and really, on a stage in front of people, pretend that I'm 11 different people and they're all talking to each other and they're screaming at each other and arguing with each other, they're killing each other, they're doing all these different things. And it's, you know, accepted. And that's very fun. So it is a bit like having imaginary friends, and it is, it's a very interesting kind of thing. I mean, if you get lost in it, I don't really remember or I'm not really that aware that they're not really real people.
Well, having seen you in Butterfly and watching you in this play move from male to female characters, I was trying again to figure out how do you make that little signature movement that's going to give away that this character is now a female? Having played in M. Butterfly, I imagine that you've thought a lot about what it is to play a woman.
Yeah, I mean, I always felt that we were all just different sexes and that there weren't that many differences, and that if you could make somebody understand a different kind of person in their perception of what a woman was, they could see that distinction. But I didn't have to do much more than enact a certain kind of person. So I didn't have to get all wrapped up in female psychology or what it meant to be a woman or what it felt like or what it meant to act like a woman. A woman was a person, and this was a certain kind of person. And I got very frustrated that you could easily resort to something that a man would perceive to be womanly, or vice versa, that a woman would seem to be manly. It gets very convoluted, but I got very frustrated that the people bought things like that so easily. I don't know why. And that people bought stereotypes and that they could perceive the woman to be a woman because she had a higher voice or something like that. That seemed very strange to me. But anyway, having a kind of ground level belief that there's not that much of a difference was kind of liberating. and I was able to think about what kind of a person the person was and imbue the, in the case of M. Butterfly, the two different aspects of the character with nuances that could be clear and almost polar.
My guest is actor B.D. Wong. What about the Miss Saigon controversy about Jonathan Pryce playing the role of an Asian? You came down and you were very critical of the decision, I guess, of the producers and directors to go with him. Why?
Well, it's not necessarily, you know, quote unquote, to go with him. A lot of the reaction to the casting of the actor was not related to the casting of the actor per se, but to the fact that the directors and the producers said, well, we went all over the world and looked for an Asian actor. None was suitable. None was qualified. None was able or good enough. In which case, a huge community of actors said, that does not sound right. That sounds a little bit like the excuse used against affirmative action in many different businesses. And then it was found out that no search was made. No such search was made. Well, then it became an excuse to just hire an actor when another actor could have at least been considered. There is an issue of yellow face, and what yellow face means, you know, yellow face is the Asian equivalent of blackface, and what yellow face means in this decade, after decades of being treated by in the media a certain way, and blackface is certainly not accepted, absolutely not accepted. Now, it could be accepted in an artistic context if the artist or the director were saying something through blackface about blackface or about something. However, this was just like a Charlie Chan movie to many of us. It was a Caucasian actor donning yellow face, taping his eyelids, and purporting to present the Asian experience. That was a whole other political issue. Now, that issue might not necessarily be able to be used to keep an actor from being employed. However, that was just an angry issue that became part of the fat that went on the fire, too. The fact that issue was discussed was very valuable. And I think that the issue of the equivalence of yellow face to black face, I think the point was made very clearly.
Let me reintroduce you. And I'm speaking today with actor B.D. Wong. And he first made a huge name for himself on Broadway. He played the Peking opera star in M. Butterfly and earned a number of awards for that, including the Drama Desk Award, the Outer Critics Circle Award, among others. And he's in Philadelphia in a play called Herringbone, in which he plays all the parts, and there are 11 of them. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor B.D. Wong. Let me find a little bit about how you got into acting, how you became an actor. Were you a young child that was in a lot of high school plays or junior high school plays? Is that when you started acting?
Yeah, I was. I was always rather creative. I mean, I was always rather kind of making things or interested in art class and arts and crafts time at school, and not interested in playing ball so much. And so I was taken to art class at the local museum, and I was given violin lessons, and my dad took me to the ballet and stuff like that. And I was not really interested in performing at all. I was just kind of creative young person. And I began playing the violin, and then I realized I didn't really like playing the violin very much. I was playing for all my teachers and stuff, and I became involved in high school productions and school productions, and I became immediately hooked.
These would be high school plays?
Yes.
Yeah.
And some community theater plays and semi-professional plays, you know, as time went on. And my parents, who were quite alarmed, as parents can be, you know, they wanted us to, you know, find our individual interests, but they weren't so sure. They wanted me to be an actor, and neither was I so sure that I wanted to be an actor, partly because being an actor is such a risky thing in general, and partly because it seemed, for a young Asian boy, quite an undignified kind of, you know, career. Why would you want to do that? You know, look what there is for you. Nothing. If there is anything, it's rather embarrassing. So why would you want to do that? And I thought, well, you know, if I'm really good, maybe people will, things will change or something like that. So they...
And these were thoughts you had as a teenager?
Yes, yes. Because I watched, like, the Brady Bunch, and I watched Hawaii Five-O, and I thought, gosh, that's very, you know, there's a lot of girls dancing around in hula skirts and stuff like that. But Asian people, that was the other, my other problem was that I didn't have any role models as an Asian American. I've been fortunate enough to be able to go to some colleges and visit colleges, and I have a speech that I do. And part of the, one of the things that I talk about in the speech is how my lack of role models caused me to have a very low sense of self-esteem as an Asian American. I was not proud of my Asian Americanism, my ethnicity. I wanted to be a white person. I wished I could be a white person so that I could succeed in society. And part of that was not having those actors in dignified positions. So I sought to try to go another route and to try to find an Americanness that I could be happy with. And
but what did that look like? I mean, how did you create that for yourself? What even is the image?
Well, the image was like to be like, you know, Joe next door. I mean, I wanted to just be an American person and to show people that not all Asian people had an accent and all of that stuff, which is not the most, for I didn't want to do it for the most healthy of reasons. I wanted to do it because I wished I was a white person at that time. Now, there is a value in that Americanness. I mean, I think there is a value in showing us all that we all share the soil and that we all, you know, have equal aspirations and that we all have some of the same problems. However, I didn't need to abandon my ethnicity to do that. And I'm sorry if I ever did that. M. Butterfly was quite a turning point in me as in my self-esteem department as an Asian American person. I was immediately instilled with a huge amount of pride, and I felt like I was, to a certain extent, carrying a message of Asian people, which was wonderful to me.
After M. Butterfly, and you played that for about a year and a half, how many scripts did you get that were written for transvestites?
I did get a lot of, like, Miami Vice, like, killer transvestite, pulls off the wig in the end. Oh, my God, it's a man. You know, that kind of stuff. There were a few of those. Not as many as I thought. I thought there was going to be, like, tons of them.
Before M. Butterfly, and I don't know whether you mark your acting career as before and after M. Butterfly.
Oh, you're right. BMB.
But here I am doing it. What specifically were some of the roles that you were offered in Hollywood?
Well, I mean, the things were very small, and I was always like a busboy in a Chinese restaurant, or I was a member of a teenage gang on a television show called The Shell Game. And I was able to kind of avoid specific stereotyping, either because of my own kind of indignance about it or because maybe I didn't do those undignified things very well. I just couldn't get myself to do them. A friend of mine says, you know, I've done roles, you know, where I said, God, I hope that wasn't stereotypical, because sometimes you do something and you don't know. And a close friend of mine, a great actress, says, you know, I don't think you have it in you to do it in that way. And I hoped that she's right. Anyway, those were basically the things that you got. You always got a lot of Chinese cooks and things like that.
And did you find directors pushing you to, you know, to play up the stereotype?
Absolutely. I mean, that is the huge problem. The ignorance by people, the ignorance that people have, which causes them to say, well, you know, it'd be a lot funnier, you know, really punch up the accent there, you know, really, can you do a little more of the, you know, whatever. And it's like if you've ever seen the Robert Townsend's movie, The Hollywood Shuffle, he does a great, he discusses that a lot in his movies. He discussed it in his two movies, the Hollywood Shuffle and the Five Heartbeats, about what it's like for an actor of color to go to an audition and have somebody say, well, yeah, you know, do that thing that you black folk do, you know, and stick your butt out and stuff like that. And that's not unlike some of the experiences that actors like myself have had when it comes to speaking with choppy accents or, you know, I'm sure that a lot of my portrayals were too dignified for certain things, not funny enough. And a lot of times I will say, well, you know, that's really, you know, you take them aside a lot.
These would be the directors.
Yes. You, if you care about it as much as I do, you end up having to take people aside a lot. And it gets in the way of just being able to act, which is unfortunate. All of a sudden you're like some kind of activist or advocate or something. But if you care about it, you have to do it. And you say, excuse me, but this particular thing is not very dignified, or I think people might be upset by it. You always tell them that other people might be upset by it, then it might get somewhere. However, a lot of times the answer is, but it's so much funnier this way. Mm. Or it's so much more of what we want for this scene. It's so important. And I played a gang lord in this movie called Mystery Date. Now, this is AMB, After M. Butterfly. And I said, well, I'll take this part. But he is a kind of a wealthy Chinese restaurant owner. He's supposed to be the head of this huge kind of Chinese mafia. And they kept saying more sinister, more sinister. And I wanted him to be funnier, more with a sense of humor. And without an accent. He was very suave. He was like a playboy and stuff like that. And they kept saying, but it's so much funnier and so much better when he's sinister. He's got to be a threat to these young Caucasian hip kids. And I wanted him to be an ensemble. As an actor, I wanted to be, not only did I want to avoid the stereotype, but I wanted to be a member of the comic ensemble. They were getting all these laughs and I was just the heavy. Well, I tried very hard to kind of avoid that. And I was relatively successful, man. I took the director aside a lot on this movie. Mm. About the costuming, about the dialect, about the costuming of the extras even. I mean, I got into like stuff that was not my territory, you know, and stuff like that. But I felt really that it was very important.
Well, B.D. Wong, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's actor B.D. Wong. He's currently performing in Philadelphia in the one-man show, Herringbone. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Hi, Linda. What stories are you bringing us from Los Angeles?
Marty, Robert Siegel is in Los Angeles, and today he talks to high school students, a class of Hispanic students and another class of black students, about what happened. We'll also be hearing about disruptions in both the legal and illegal economies in South Central Los Angeles. And there is a new political poll in the wake of what happened in L.A., which shows President Bush, Governor Bill Clinton, and Ross Perot in a virtual dead heat. We'll also be covering other places in the world where there is violence, in Kabul in Afghanistan and Sarajevo in Bosnia.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Going a bit out on a limb, world music commentator Milo Miles hails the Turium Quartet from St. Petersburg. He says it's the ideal band for Russia right now, a group that couldn't have existed in the past, but with a strong sense of history and plunging into an uncertain future. Thank you.
What I know about Russian folk ensembles wouldn't even fill a vodka shot glass. So my enthusiasm for the Terium Quartet has everything to do with their wit and brio and nothing to do with their authenticity or virtuosity, though they're certainly adept with their instruments. And the instrumental makeup of the quartet is slightly odd by Western standards. Andrei Smirnov plays a species of accordion with such a soulful, melancholy tone that it must have been a violin in another life. Igor Ponomarenko and Andrei Konstantinov pluck domras, which are a bit like mandolins and a bit like banjos. And finally, Mikhail Dzudzi plays the very uncommon bass balalaika, which looks like a triangular card table with three strings attached. Their debut U.S. album is called simply Terium, and most of the tunes on it are short and speedy. The 14 tracks are not quite 40 minutes long. This suggests that their closest counterpart over here may be a bluegrass ensemble. Terium Quartet also display a peculiarly Russian mordant humor and play numerous bits of musical satire. They are going to be irreverent whether you balalaika it or not. Now, if you wince too hard at that, you might have trouble with Terium because some of the quartet's jokes are almost that flagrant. The Terium album includes some pleasant, self-effacing variations on Swan Lake and a few more somber, experimental cuts as well. These are the quartet's most arresting accomplishments, unclassifiable meditations that suggest twilight rituals in a Siberian fairy tale. With all of Russia's agonies at the moment, the Terium Quartet is a spot of good news indeed.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. The Terium Quartet's album is on the Real World label. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tui, Sue Weinstein, and Sue Spolin, who also directed today's show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Gail Sheehy became famous for her best-selling book, Passages, in which she described the changing phases of an adult life. Now she's focused on the one phase of a woman's life that no one wants to talk about. Menopause. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Gail Sheehy about the silent passage. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.